When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very pleased today to be speaking with Dr. Sharona Pearl about her book, just out from Bloomsbury in 2024, part of the Object Lesson series titled Mask. Now, obviously, we probably have a decent amount of experience with masks in a lot of different contexts. They might be theater masks, they might be masquerade. Of course, we've had a lot of experience in the past few years with protective masks. So really, there's a lot to talk about here. Sharona, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me, Miranda.
Could you please start us off by introducing yourself a little bit and explain why you decided to write this book?
Absolutely. So I'm trained as a historian of science and medicine, and my research broadly is around the face, why we think we know people based on how they look, what kinds of assumptions we make around the face, what happens when we change our faces. Ultimately, I tend to think that the things we think about other people's faces says more about us than them. And I actually had just completed a book that came out in the fall with Johns Hopkins University Press on the face recognition spectrum, from face blindness to super recognition. And I was talking to my editor as I was literally handing in the book. And he said, "You know, Sharona, over the past couple of years," because I wrote the book between 2020 and 2022, "you've written a lot about masks." And I said, "Well, yes, it makes sense given my research." And I didn't quite imagine that my rather niche area of interest would be the kind of thing that would relate to the experiences of the entire world. But that's what happened with COVID and pandemic masking. He said, "Yes, so you've essentially written a book." And I said, "I know, I'm giving it to you." And he said, No, you've basically written a book about masks." And I said, "Well, I just wrote a book, Matt, so I'm not really sure if I'm ready to write another one." He said, "No, you have to write a book about masks." And then at that point, it was really kind of a wonderful and fortuitous experience. I reached out to the editors at Object Lessons. They were quite excited about the idea. And I was able to sit with this thing that had really consumed us and think about it more expansively and in a broader context, which, well, I wouldn't say that it was healing. It was a powerful experience to write while we were sitting and watching the pandemic unfold.
Really interesting kind of how that came together without even you realizing it first. So thank you for taking us back to the beginning of the project. If we can move then to the beginning of the book, how do you define masks in this book, and how did you come up with this?
That's an astute question, because of course, almost anything can be a mask. Anything that covers something is a kind of mask, right? Is a tablecloth a mask, right? Are curtains a mask? If we define it as a thing that covers a thing, then it's infinite. So one of the things that I did at the beginning of the book was essentially create some guidelines, almost arbitrary, around what we were going to think about. And in particular, I was interested in that which covers the face. And even more specifically, one of my claims in the book, or one of the things that I use to unify it, is to think about how masks always in some way serve to protect. So we can think about the different things that masks protect as a way to see what we value in a given moment in time, or what we think is worthy of protection. So if we take COVID masking, for example, on one hand, and in the early days, we thought it was to protect the wearer. And then we learned a little more. It was actually to protect other people from the wearer. And our relationship to wearing that particular mask actually says a lot about what we value.
Can you tell us a bit more about the rules?
Sure. I decided, again, somewhat arbitrary, that they would specifically be that which covered the face, provided a barrier, and in some way both concealed, and this is one of the claims that I make throughout the book, also in so doing reveal. So we would look at that which provided a cover specifically for the face. So that would let out head coverings, wigs, so on and so forth. And it would have to be something that served as both a form of protection, let's say from identity, as per masks that you use in acts of civil disobedience or to commit crimes or to just avoid knowing who you are, right? Masks that quite literally protect you from, let's say, pucks flying at your eyes if you're a hockey goalie, right? Masks that you use in religious contexts. And that's where things get sort of interesting. What does it tell us when we try to prohibit people from covering their faces in various contexts? It tends to be related to this idea that people are trying to hide their identities and do things anonymously, which we associate with crime. But there are all kinds of domains where people choose to cover their faces that aren't about committing crimes, that aren't about trying to avoid having your identity detected. And who we do allow to cover and who we don't, again, tells us a lot about the value that we place on people in particular contexts.
Hmm. Yeah, no, those rules themselves already, as you said, raise quite a lot of questions and a lot of potential topics for exploration. Of course, that's challenging with any book, but object lessons are cute and tiny and, you know, black on the cover. So that makes the idea of the decision of what to include versus not kind of even more intense. How did you decide what to include in the book? And can you briefly give us an overview of those topics?
I can. And I'll tell you a little bit of an anecdote as well. When I started to write the series, my partner said, don't you think you ought to read some of them first? And I said, yes, that's a very good idea. And I called them up and they very kindly sent me a wonderful stack of various different object lessons books. And I sat down and I tackled them. And I started on the one with socks. And it's really about socks, Miranda. It's about when the first socks were discovered. And if socks are your area of interest, this is the book for you. But I thought, I don't know if I can write a mask book that looks like the sock book. They're just so expansive. There's so much theory behind it, so much cultural context. And then I read the one about hoods. And the one about hoods is about hoods, but it's also about racial violence. It's also about concealment. And I started to think, oh, all right, I'm starting to feel like there's probably more scope. And then I read the one about hotels. And the thing is that I would have been very interested to read the sock book about hotels because I think hotels are fascinating. They're everywhere. They're nowhere. They're homey, but they're also sort of anonymous. And this book is actually this extended Freudian mediation. It's really theoretical. And then I realized, oh, this book could be about anything. And as an academic or someone who, even though I do a lot of freelance writing, I trained as a historian, as I said, that's liberating, but also terrifying because we tend to be quite bounded in what we write about. So to have the entire world of ideas open was really a journey of self-discovery. If I can write about anything, what do I write about? And it turns out that I, Sharona Pearl, if told you can write a mask book about anything, will write a book about basically religion and television. So while there are a number of different domains that I talk about physiognomy, which is the idea that dates back to antiquity, that you can learn something about somebody's character based on their physical features of their face. I talk about protection. I talk about theatrical masks. Mostly, I spend a lot of time thinking about masking in the context of religion, concealment, and revelation, and also the way that masks happen in screen media. Now, of course, I also touch on COVID fairly extensively, and I think through masks in different domains, for example, war masks, gas masks, and so on and so forth. But the real focus in a particular way is religion and television and film.
Hmm. Thank you for giving us that kind of grounding, and especially the process of how you got to it. I think that's an interesting way to understand sort of where you ended up. And in a lot of ways, I kind of want to ask about a theme that I noticed reading the book that came out throughout those areas. It came up when you talked about religion. It came up when you talked about screen, the portrayals on screen. And of course, it came up in the context of COVID. So I wonder if I can ask sort of a thematic point, I suppose. You mention at one point in the book that writing about the mask is inevitably to write about trust. And it seemed to come up whenever you were talking about masks. And really kind of, even if we think of screen portrayals and religion as being very different contexts, there were still questions about trust. So I wonder if maybe you can speak to that point.
Certainly. So this harkens a little bit back to the question of protection, revealment, and concealment. One of the things that a mask does, and certainly the masks, based on my somewhat arbitrary rules as I define them for the context of this book, provides a barrier from people being able to access your face and see the features of your face. Now, on some level, I think that our interest in seeing the face of the people that we interact with has a lot to do with this practice that dates back to antiquity of physiognomy, of the idea that if we see somebody, we know something about them, right? In the 19th century, this practice became very, very articulated and defined. If your lips are thin, then you have more avarice. If your ears are pointed, you're this sort of person. If you have this kind of nose, perhaps you lack determination, and so on and so forth. A lot of that had to do with people moving to cities and needing new techniques to get to know each other in shorter amounts of time. But it really lingers in all of these kinds of ways. We really just want to see people's faces. Obviously, not everybody has access to that. And obviously, there are all kinds of people's faces we can't access in various ways. But this is one of the fundamental building blocks of how we relate to others, how we form relationships, how we know people, how we recognize them. So to have that interrupted, even just for certain features as opposed to the whole face, really does cause a reevaluation of how we encounter other people. There's a lot of trust built into that, right? We trust people that we know, but also in order to know someone, we do on some level have to see them in some way. We have to recognize them. We have to encounter them. So when the mask interrupts that, it interrupts our ability to see and recognize people. There's a way that it feels like it undermines our ability to know them. Now, this is not actually necessarily true, right? There are all kinds of ways that we can encounter people and know them without seeing their faces. But the way that this plays out, connected both to physiognomy and, as I said, this idea that if people are concealing their faces, it's in order to do something that would require anonymity, then there is some level of discomfort and distrust built into not being able to see somebody. But I think that that's really contingent. It's really variable culturally and otherwise. For example, we trust our doctors even when they're covering their faces. We don't feel any kind of resistance to people who are skiing and are wearing masks or balaclavas in order to be warm. We still admire our sports figures whose faces are covered through masks in order to protect them. So why is that in particular that we have rules in multiple places in the world against, for example, Muslim women who cover their faces because they veil in certain ways? So the argument there is it's less about the fact of masking, but who is doing the masking.
And that speaks to as well the point you make around who's excluded, either from, oh, someone's feeling excluded because they can't see their face, or who's excluded and kind of what permissions are allowed. Can you talk a bit about what you mean by exclusion?
Certainly. It's a question of who participates in the populace, but it's also certain spaces that people have access to. So during the pandemic, a number of women who wear niqab wrote quite movingly about the ironies of, for example, in Quebec and in France, not being allowed to enter, say, a hospital without wearing a pandemic mask, as was appropriate, but not being allowed to enter if they were wearing their head coverings or veils, because there were rules against that. So who are we allowing to participate in the populace and access certain kinds of spaces? And who do we not allow access to those spaces? Now, there's emotional resonances to this as well. I pull this out. It's something that stuck with me for years and years, and I never really imagined that it would come to play or be relevant. But there was this show called JAG, Judge Advocate General, that was about a lawyer in the Navy. And there was a particular episode, and I didn't even watch it that much, but this stuck out in my mind, when one of the characters was serving in Saudi Arabia and she had to testify while appearing in traditional Muslim garb. And she really was incredibly uncomfortable with being obscured in that way. So there are questions around what you might not be able to access when you are covered, how people might not be able to encounter you and see you in particular ways. And we certainly felt that discomfort, right? People wanted to be able to see the faces of other people during the pandemic. But there, I think the issue becomes one of choice and agency. Are you choosing? Are you in a position to opt into making decisions about what parts of yourself are revealed or seen? Or are you being forced to do this? And do not take that as any kind of anti-masking statement. It isn't. I do think that forms of autonomy and agency can sometimes be suspended temporarily to participate in public space for public health reasons. But I would say that our own forms of concealment and revealing as we expose our faces ought to be under our control in most cases.
Hmm. I wonder if I can ask specifically about another religious example. You've mentioned, obviously, Muslim women wearing face coverings or head coverings of various kinds. And of course, that's come up quite a lot, given news, given legislation, much more than just in the last few years. But you talk about in the book a different religious context in which masks are a key part and have been for quite a long time, but maybe we haven't interrogated them or thought about them as much. I'm speaking about the Jewish celebration of Purim. Can you talk a bit about the significance of masks in that context?
Absolutely. And we're not far from the holiday of Purim. It's quite late this year. So I'm smiling. You can't see it, but I'm smiling right now because we just had our celebration. So the holiday of Purim actually incorporates masks as part of its revelry, part of the festival of the day. There's all kinds of traditions around this holiday that are built around the notion of v'nahafochu, and things get inverted. It's a holiday of inversion to the extent that, and there's debate about how this plays out, but there's this kind of idea that you become intoxicated to the point where you can't tell the difference between the good guy, Mordechai, and the bad guy, Haman. But I think there's also a play there that is forcing us to really interrogate our own categories of who is good and who is bad. So the idea of the mask is another one of these inversions that the argument is that sometimes when you're masked, you actually are concealed, but in so doing, that can reveal other kinds of truths, right? You can actually be open to understanding different kinds of things about yourself, about the world. So this holiday also really forces us to reimagine various forms of relationships, what counts as good, what counts as bad, through the tradition of masking. It really asks us to think about our own categories of villain and hero. And there's really a very powerful history to this as well, right? So there was a tradition of women wearing masks in the 16th century, 17th century, in order to participate in the populace in ways that they couldn't if they were from an aristocratic class. There's also, I would say, online, people, when they become anonymous, have the ability to behave in ways that they might otherwise not do, because the anonymity or the escape from restrictions around behavior that might be tied to identifying you allow you to behave as you truly wish to be. Unfortunately, online, that has often revealed people to be actually incredibly cruel and problematic when they are not concerned about repercussions. So there's a way, too, that the mask can reveal an inner core that is not something that we necessarily would celebrate.
But very interesting to think about, especially, as you said, in this time of year. I wonder if there's anything, especially given what you told us at the beginning about kind of how you came to this book. It was very much based off of research and work you were already doing and already very familiar with. Is there anything you came across in the research or writing or putting this book together that surprised you?
Yes. I think that I really hadn't imagined that there would be such a strong through line around the way that anonymity can reveal certain things about who we are, right? So that has so much resonance today in the online world, but the way that that appeared in digital, in analog contexts with women wearing masks in order to participate in the populace, or even going further back, the way that masks in religious ceremonies that were also really performative could blur the line between this world and the next in particular ways and actually enable people to transform themselves into deities by donning masks. That itself became a form of transformation. And I didn't really expect that this thing that, as you said, is so expansive and in its own way, really, really challenging to nail down, would actually have so much resonance across time and space. And also with echoes in the way that they manifest on screens.
Do you want to tell us a bit more about that last part?
Sure. So I isolate in the book a number of different examples. I talk about the wonderful HBO adaptation of the comic book, The Watchmen, which really asks the question, who watches the watchers, right? So there we have a kind of moment where people, the police cover their faces and wear masks, basically in order to be able to do their jobs without fear of repercussions. But that really raises the question of who watches the watchers, right? If people who have that much power can act with impunity, then aren't we in fact giving them license to do whatever it is they want? And there are good guys, but there are certainly bad guys. And we see this in multiple kinds of moments of masking, from the really famous scenes in Mission Impossible of people wearing masks in order to literally be another person. They have excellent technologies of masking where you can actually take on the face of another character, to, you know, shows like Motherland Fort Salem, which is all about witches, but also has a technology of people wearing masks to be somebody else. And sometimes this is in the service of good, the sort of classic superhero narrative of doing the right thing and saving the world. But one of the wonderful things about Watchmen is that it really inverts that story, particularly with strong resonances around the history of racial violence. And it really calls to mind the masks worn by the Ku Klux Klan in order to commit their acts of violence. This is another example of anonymity and masks allowing anonymity and really violent behavior. But there, it was often the people in control, in power, who were charged with protecting others who had donned the masks to give them plausible deniability.
We've spoken now of a bunch of examples that kind of play with this inverting the idea of sort of who gets to use violence, who gets to have identity, how is that expressed? We've done that in a bunch of ways, which I think is what makes the kind of collection of ideas in the book so interesting. Is there one thing you hope readers take away from the book? Are there multiple things you hope people come away with?
I hope that people reimagine what it means to encounter somebody in the face-to-face moment. While I understand and research in depth the power of the face-to-face encounter, I think that the opportunity of masking or the denial of the face is an opportunity for interruption around the assumptions we make about other people based on what they look like and what they see. So I suppose I really do want people to internalize the message of Purim and Vinaha Fochu and inversion and concealment and revealing, and understand, as the message of that holiday is, that often our relationships are themselves masked, and in order to really relate to other people and really understand our own place in the world, we have to interrupt those kind of business as usual decisions. So instead of seeing the mask as a denial of encounter or a moment of anonymity when someone is trying not to connect or not to be known, perhaps let's push further and think about what other things we can see beneath or around or through or with a mask.
Hmm. a very interesting thought, I think, for people to take away with. Obviously, this project, as you mentioned at the beginning, very much came out of your previous one. As a final question, can I ask if you're working on anything next? Is there another mask book?
There is another mask book that other people are writing that's going to be fantastic. And I've had the opportunity to see it, but I don't think it's out yet, so I shouldn't say more. I currently am thinking a little bit about age progression technology. So in my last book, I ended up thinking about face recognition technology, of course, and surveillance, incursions into privacy. And I touch on that a little bit in this book as well, around people who try to evade detection through plastic surgery. Is cosmetic surgery itself a kind of mask as we try to look like other people or look less like ourselves? And I became interested in what happens when we don't know what people look like over time. Everybody's face changes, right? Ultimately, what a lot of plastic surgery does is to try to change people by stopping change, right? Trying to freeze time, which itself is absolutely not going to work. So what about those people who, you know, we don't get to see how they change over time? How does age technology, age progression technology come in to both contribute to panics around kidnapped children, which is a whole particular narrative, fugitives who escaped justice and now is being co-opted by cosmetics industry, by data mining, all of those memes, this is you in 10 years, tag yourself, is actually contributing to a lot of these surveillance mechanisms. So certainly still thinking about the face and certainly still thinking about the stakes for the face, but in a slightly different context.
Well, that sounds absolutely fascinating. And based off this book, I think there's going to be loads of things in the next one as well that I'm sure will kind of be threads of continuity. But of course, many things to think about while you work on that. So thank you for telling us about your beautiful, delightful, cute as well. Object lessons books are always really cute. So anyone who's looking to work to think about the mask and all of these questions that are raised, this is a very accessible way into those debates. It's obviously published by Bloomsbury, and equally obviously, it's called Mask. Thank you so much, Sharona, for being with us to tell us about it.
Thank you so much for talking with me. And I have to say, it really was such a wonderful experience to think about this. And also, it was one of those moments where if I were to say to everyone in the audience, mask, right? You're all thinking about COVID right now. And to say this isn't a book about the pandemic is like saying, don't think about elephants, right? You're only going to get to think about elephants henceforth and onward. So some of this was about dealing with our collective challenges, resistance, pain, the kind of weaponization of masks on a broad social level, because this life-saving device in a medical context really became weaponized in particular ways. And also to recover that there was a richness and a multivalence and a real sense of possibility around knowing people in other ways when their faces are concealed.
Wonderful. So many things to think about. Thank you again for being with us.
All right. Thank you so much.